I want you to picture a scenario that I think, we have probably all been in at some point.
Okay, lay on me.
You are standing in a cafeteria line. You've got your tray. It's lunchtime. You're starving. And you look up, and there are like 100 different options.
Oh, yeah. The endless buffet.
Right. You've got the salad bar, the hot station, sandwich press, pizza, soups. And for a split second, you freeze. You have absolutely no idea what the right choice is.
Because it's just too much.
Exactly. It's just too much.
Yeah, that is a very specific and I'd say very common type of anxiety. It's essentially the paradox of choice. You know, when you have too many options, you don't actually feel free, you feel paralyzed.
Right, you feel paralyzed. But I want to take that feeling, that cafeteria paralysis, I guess, and apply it to basically everything right now.
Oh, wow. Okay.
I mean, open your phone, you've got the news, politics, 20 different scientific studies, and whether coffee is good or bad for you this week.
Always conflicting, yeah. Always. And influencers telling you how to raise your kids, financial gurus screaming about crypto. Everyone is just shouting that they have the answer, you know, with a capital A.
Right.
Honestly, sometimes it just makes me want to crawl under a rock. It's not just confusing, it's deeply exhausting.
It is exhausting, but it's also the perfect headspace to be in to understand the topic of our deep dive today.
Yes, it is.
Because that feeling, that overwhelmed, I don't know what's true anymore vibe, it really isn't a modern problem. It was actually the exact mood of the Hellenistic period in ancient Greece.
Which is wild to think about.
Yeah.
So today we are digging into Greek and Roman skepticism. And, you know, before you roll your eyes and think, oh, great, a bunch of philosophy bros who just doubt everything to be annoying.
Which is how we usually use the word today.
Exactly, yeah. Hold on, because this deep dive, which we've pulled from a really fascinating lecture on the history of philosophy by Dr. Arthur Holmes, it suggests that skepticism wasn't just about being difficult.
No, not at all.
It was a survival strategy. That's a great way to put it. We do often think of a skeptic today as just a cynic or maybe a debunker, you know, someone who just wants to tear down your ideas.
Right, the person at the party who just says actually to everything.
Exactly. But the original movement wasn't about negativity. It was this highly rigorous philosophical system designed to achieve something we all desperately want, which is peace of mind.
And that is our mission for this deep dive. We are going to explore how these ancient thinkers handled a crumbling world by asking a pretty radical question, which is, what if the smartest thing you can possibly do is admit, absolutely nothing?
And we're going to see how that simple yet really profound admission rippled out to shape the Renaissance, the scientific method, and even how we think about faith and logic today.
So let's set the scene. Dr. Holmes describes the Hellenistic period as a time of massive fragmentation.
Yes, things were falling apart.
You had the Golden Age of Athens in the rearview mirror. The big, confident systems of Plato and Aristotle were sort of, they were being questioned. The city-states were losing their power.
Yeah, it really feels like the rug was being pulled out from under everyone.
Exactly. So what happens then?
Well, that is the crucial context. Skepticism emerged as the third major movement of this era, right alongside Stoicism and Epicureanism. And Dr. Holmes points out a really fascinating historical pattern here.
Yeah, this blew my mind a little bit.
Right. He notes that skepticism isn't random. It always seems to pop up whenever big systematic ways of thinking collapse.
So it's almost like a cultural reflex. Like when the official story breaks, people just stop trusting stories altogether.
Precisely. It happened at the end of the Greek classic period. It happened again at the end of the Middle Ages. And it happened again at the conclusion of the Enlightenment.
Wow.
Whenever a culture loses its unifying theory of how the world works, people retreat into skepticism.
And there was one connection in the source material that actually surprised me. Dr. Holmes calls it a flash forward. He talks about the Renaissance.
Ah, he
Now, when
said.
I think Renaissance, I think Michelangelo and Da Vinci and, looking really cool in tights. I don't think crippling doubt.
Most people don't, but if you look closer, it was definitely there. Holmes calls it an epistemological vacuum.
An epistemological vacuum, so a vacuum of knowing how to know things.
Exactly. Think about the 1500s. You have the Protestant Reformation happening.
Right.
So suddenly, the ultimate authority for over 1,000 years, the church, is being questioned on a massive scale.
Right.
And at the exact same time, modern science is starting to rise up and challenge the ancient views of nature.
So the church says one thing, the scientists say another, the Protestants say a third thing.
And nobody knows who to trust. The old rule book was totally thrown out the window.
Yeah.
And in that vacuum, thinkers like Montaigne, Pascal, and eventually Descartes, they actually went back and read the ancient Greek skeptics.
Which is wild. They were dusting off these ancient texts just to survive their own century.
Right. They weren't doing it for fun. They were trying to figure out if it was possible to know anything for sure in a world where everything was up for grabs.
Which brings us back to the source, the OG skeptic, the man who started it all in Greece. Pyrrho of Elis.
Yes, Pyrrho. He's the father of what we call Pyrrhonian skepticism, and he really boiled his entire philosophy down to a framework of three big questions.
Okay, let's unpack these, because I think they're the absolute key to understanding this whole mindset. Question one, what is the nature of things?
And Pyrrho's answer is simply unknown.
Okay, let me play devil's advocate here. Is he saying things don't exist? Like, is he saying this table between us isn't real?
No, not necessarily. He's saying we can't know the true nature of the table.
Because of our senses.
Exactly. He argued that our senses are changeable. Honey tastes sweet to me, but if you're sick, it might taste bitter to you. The wind feels cold to you, but warm to me.
Okay, so since our measuring tools, our senses, and our reason are flawed, we can't get to the objective reality.
Right. We are trapped in our own perspective. We only know the appearance of things, not the reality behind the appearance.
That naturally leads to question two. If we can't know the nature of things, what should our attitude be toward the world?
His answer is epic. That's the Greek word for suspension of judgment.
Epoch. So this isn't saying I believe X is false.
No, not at all.
It's saying I refuse to decide if X is true or false.
It is withholding assent. You just step out of the game entirely.
And that leads to the third question, which I actually think is the most important one for us. What is the value of this attitude? Why on earth would you want to walk around never deciding anything? That sounds paralyzing.
Right. It sounds like that cafeteria line again. But this is where the twist comes in. The answer isn't truth or accuracy. The answer is quietude.
Or ataraxia.
Yes, ataraxia.
Freedom from trouble. Peace of mind. Dr. Holmes points out this is actually the same goal the Stoics and Epicureans had. Everyone just wanted to stop worrying.
It's a very pragmatic goal when you think about it. Pyrrho is basically saying, look, you are stressed out because you are trying to defend a position you can't possibly prove.
Right, you're fighting on Twitter.
Exactly. You're fighting over whether the universe is made of fire or water, or you're arguing about politics or theology. If you just admit you don't know, the fight ends. You get peace.
So skepticism is basically a stress reduction technique.
In its original form, yes. It was quite literally therapy for the intellect.
I love the concept they used to achieve this. Equipollence. It sounds like a heavy metal band, but it's actually this brilliant mental hack.
Equipollence means of equal weight. And the discipline is this. For every argument you can make for a position, let's call it argument A, I can find an equally convincing argument against it, argument B.
And if they have equal weight,
they cancel each other out.
Wow.
You're left with zero. You're paralyzed, but in a good way. You're completely free from the burden of having to pick a side.
It's like when two sports teams are so evenly matched, the game ends in a tie, and the fans just go home shrugging instead of rioting.
That's a very fair analogy. And later, a thinker named Sextus Empiricus sanctimized all of this. He defined skepticism not as a set of beliefs, because remember, skeptics aren't supposed to have beliefs.
Right.
He defined it as an ability. The ability to oppose appearances and judgments in a way that leads to that suspension of judgment.
But wait, there's a brain twister here that Dr. Holmes brings up, and it honestly kind of broke my brain for a minute.
The self-refutation trap.
Yes. If a skeptic says, we can't know the truth, isn't that a truth claim? Do they know that they don't know?
Ah, yes. This is the classic weapon used against skeptics. If you say nothing is true, well, then that statement itself isn't true.
Right. Gotcha.
But the Pyrrhonists were slippery. They would say, no, we don't even know if we don't know.
That is maddening. It's like arguing with a toddler who just keeps saying maybe.
It's totally maddening, but it is consistent. They distinguish themselves from dogmatists, people who claim to know the truth, and negative dogmatists, who are the people who claim it is absolutely impossible to know the truth.
So what does the true skeptic say?
The true skeptic just says, I don't know. Yet I'm still looking.
I'm still looking.
Yeah.
That is a very open-ended way to live. But they didn't just sit around shrugging all day. They had weapons.
Oh, they had an entire arsenal.
Dr. Holmes lists the tropes, or the modes of Agrippa. These are basically five ways to shut down any argument at a dinner party.
Or to stop yourself from forming a dogmatic belief. These are the tools of the trade.
Let's run through them because I think they're actually really useful for critical thinking today. First one is conflicting views.
This is the easiest one. You just point out that smart people disagree. Plato says X, Aristotle says Y. If the experts can't agree, why should I be certain?
Simple enough. Second one is infinite regress.
This is the Y game. If you make a claim, I ask for proof. Then I ask for proof of your proof and proof of that proof.
And since you can't go back forever,
eventually you have to stop and just assert something without proof.
And the skeptic catches you there.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. You just stopped proving things.
Exactly.
Okay, third one is relativity.
We touched on this with the senses. Things appear differently to different people. The room feels hot to you, cold to me. The heavy rock feels light to a strong person. Who is right? Neither. It's relative to the observer.
So objective truth is out the window. Fourth.
Dogmatism. This is pointing out when someone just asserts something because they want it to be true, you catch them saying, well, it just is. And you say, that's an assumption, not a fact.
And finally, the fifth one.
Circularity. Begging the question. Using your conclusion as your premise, like saying the book is true because it says it's true in the book.
So with these five moves, conflicting views, infinite regress, relativity, dogmatism, and circularity, you can basically dismantle any claim to absolute certainty. It's like a demolition crew for ideas.
That was exactly the goal. To undermine the dogmatists, usually the Stoics or Aristotelians of the time, who claimed they had found the bedrock truth.
But here's my problem with all this. If I'm a hardcore Pyrrhonian skeptic and I suspend judgment on literally everything, how do I eat? How do I walk down the street without getting hit by a chariot?
Right. If you don't know if the chariot is real, why would you dodge it? That is the practical problem. Total paralysis is not a great survival strategy in the real world. And that's why the movement shifted over time. We move from the hardcore Pyrrhonian skeptics to what Dr. Holmes calls academic skepticism.
And just to clarify for everyone, academic here refers to Plato's academy, right?
Correct. After Plato died, his school eventually took a very skeptical turn. And the key figure here is a guy named Carneades. He is the absolute game changer.
Why? What did Carneades bring to the table?
He introduced the concept of probabilism. He realized that while we can't have absolute mathematical certainty, we also can't live in total ignorance.
We still have to dodge the chariots.
Exactly. So he argued that we can have an opinion or a belief based on probability.
Dr. Holmes used a great example here, the shopping at Stratford Center analogy.
Right. If I ask you, are you going shopping at Stratford Center tomorrow? And you say, probably not. Now, have you run a complex statistical analysis of your schedule, the weather, and traffic patterns?
No. I just know I hate shopping and I'm generally busy.
Exactly. You don't have indubitable knowledge. You aren't completely mathematically certain you won't end up there, but you have a justified belief based on your habits and expectations.
So probability is the guide of life.
Yes. Carneades argued we don't need absolute certainty to act. We just need to know what is most likely.
This feels a lot like the birth of the modern scientific mindset.
It really is. This is fallibilism. The idea is that you can hold a belief, you can act on it, you can build a whole life on it, but you simultaneously admit, I might be wrong.
Dr. Holmes quoted Oliver Cromwell here, which actually made me laugh. He said, I beseech you, in the bowels of Christ, consider that you may be wrong.
It's a bit visceral, yeah, but it's a powerful plea for intellectual humility. For Carneades, a belief isn't a religious commitment to a dogma. It's just a provisional acceptance of something as likely true.
So we have the hardliners who say suspend all judgment, and the academics who say act on the best probability. But surely the other philosophers, the ones getting hammered by these skeptical arguments, they didn't just take this lying down right.
Oh no, the counterattack was fierce.
How do they fight back?
Dr. Holmes highlights two heavy hitters who tried to stop the skeptics in their tracks, Augustine and Aristotle.
Let's start with Augustine. How do you beat a guy whose entire argument is, I don't know anything?
Augustine's argument was brilliant. He essentially said, okay, let's say you're right. Let's say you doubt everything. Let's say every single thought you have is a mistake.
Okay.
But to be mistaken, you have to exist.
Si valor sum. If I err, I exist.
Exactly. It actually predates Descartes' famous, I think, therefore I am, by centuries. Augustine argued that there are some things, like your own existence, that are impossible to doubt logically.
Because the very act of doubting proves there is a doubter.
Right. It's airtight.
That's a solid philosophical uppercut. What about Aristotle?
Aristotle went for the laws of logic themselves, specifically the law of non-contradiction.
which is the idea that something cannot be both A and not A at the same time and in the same way.
Yes. And he called this a negative proof.
Why negative?
Because you can't prove logic without using logic. But Aristotle challenged the skeptics. He said, try to deny the law of non-contradiction.
Okay, the law of non-contradiction is false.
But by saying that, you are assuming your statement is true and the opposite is false. You are relying on the very law you are trying to destroy.
Wow, you just tie yourself in a knot.
Exactly. So while the skeptics were great at poking holes in specific arguments about physics or ethics, they really struggled to take down the fundamental machinery of thought itself.
Now, towards the end of the lecture, Dr. Holmes zooms out. He stops talking just about Greeks and Romans and talks about how we, you and I, and everyone listening should read the history of philosophy in general.
Right.
And I think this is where the deep dive gets really deep.
I completely agree. He outlines three ways people tend to view the history of ideas. First, there's the atomistic or pessimistic view.
Which is what?
This is the idea that history is just a series of mistakes.
So guy A says something. Guy B says he's wrong. Guy C says guy B is wrong. It's just a big pile of errors. The history of philosophy is just a history of failures.
Right, and Holmes rejects that. Then there's the optimistic view, which was famously held by Hegel. This is the idea that history is a straight line, constantly evolving toward one perfect, absolute truth.
Which feels a bit arrogant. It kind of assumes we're the ones who finally figured it all out, and everyone before us was just a stepping stone.
It does assume that. So Holmes suggests a third way, the multilinear view. Or, using the biblical metaphor he cites, the wheat and the tares.
The idea that weeds and wheat grow together in the exact same field.
Exactly. He argues that different traditions like idealism, naturalism, theism, they grow in parallel through history. They interact, they learn from each other, they clash, but they don't just cancel each other out.
And they all might contain parts of the truth.
Yes. And this leads to that concept of control beliefs. This was from Nicholas Wolterstorff, right?
Yes, and I really want to land this for you listening because I think it explains so much about our modern arguments today.
Wolterstorff argues that we all have control beliefs. These are our core assumptions or worldviews, and they act as a filter.
Okay.
When we see a new theory or a new piece of data, we run it through our control beliefs to decide if we even accept it as a possibility.
Give me an example of that in action.
Okay, let's say you are a strict materialist. Your control belief is only matter exists. If you see data that looks like a miracle, your filter rejects miracle as an option entirely.
Because it doesn't fit the filter.
Right. You must find a natural explanation, no matter how unlikely it is, because your control belief absolutely demands it.
But if my control belief is God exists, I might accept the miracle explanation.
Precisely. We are looking at the same data, but our filters dictate the conclusion. But here is the kicker. Holmes argues that even if we have completely different control beliefs, we can still find truth in other traditions.
So just because Plato wasn't a Christian or Aristotle wasn't a modern scientist doesn't mean they didn't find fragments of truth.
Yes. He talks about regathering the fragments.
That is a beautiful image.
It
suggests that truth is scattered. It's not the sole property of one single system.
No, it's not. Our job isn't to destroy every other view, but to sift through them, like separating wheat from tares, and just keep what is actually true.
Which brings us full circle back to the skeptics. They were the ones who taught us to pause, to sift, and not just swallow everything whole.
They moved philosophy from a quest for absolute dogmatic certainty, which might honestly be impossible for humans, to a quest for justified belief.
They taught us that it's okay to say, this is what seems true to me right now, but I'm open to correction.
Exactly.
So what does this all mean for us today? We started this whole thing with a cafeteria line of information overload.
I think the biggest lesson is that suspension of judgment epoch is a superpower. You really don't have to have an opinion on everything.
You don't have to win every argument on the internet.
You really don't.
And realizing that is what gives you that ataraxia, that elusive peace of mind.
Exactly. But also, taking a page from Carnegie's, even when you do have to act, you can do so with humility.
Right.
You can vote, you can invest, you can choose a career, all while whispering to yourself, I beseech you, consider that you may be wrong.
It takes the pressure off. You don't have to be a god knowing everything. You just have to be a human doing your best with the probabilities you have.
Well said.
So here is a final provocative thought for you to chew on today. We all think we see the world clearly, but if we accept this idea of control beliefs, that we are filtering absolutely everything through a lens we might not even know we have. How many of the things you are absolutely 100% certain about right now are actually just probabilities that you've treated as facts?
And if you admitted they were just probabilities, would that scare you? Or would it finally give you some peace?
Something to think about. That's it for this deep dive into skepticism. Thanks for exploring with us, and we'll catch you next time.